Right, welcome to this Weber training teleclass. This is one of the British series of teleclasses. I'm Vanessa Watley, chairing this session, lead nurse for infection prevention at the Royal Wolverhampton Hospitals. And I'd like to thank Gojo for helping to sponsor this teleclass broadcast. I'd like to introduce to you Ginny Moore. Ginny is part of the UCLH Environmental Research Group based at the Royal Free Hampstead NHS Trust in London, UK. So, Ginny, I'd like to hand over for your presentation on contamination of the ward environment and the importance of hand hygiene when leaving the patient zone, please. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Vanessa, and good afternoon, everybody. And just as a way of an introduction, as Vanessa has just said, I am part of a research group currently based at the Royal Free Hospital in London. And over the past few years, we have had the opportunity to conduct extensive sampling of different ward environments. And I'm grateful for being given the chance to share some of our findings with you today. So over the course of the next 45 minutes or so, I'm going to discuss our most recent ward survey, and using some of the results from this study, hope to illustrate the role of hands in healthcare-associated infection, highlight the role of the environment as a potential source of microorganisms, illustrate the most contaminated surfaces in two different types of ward and those that are the most frequently touched, and to demonstrate the importance of hand hygiene when leaving the patient's zone. And I'm also going to use this opportunity to discuss an automated hand hygiene monitoring system, which uses real-time feedback to improve hand hygiene compliance. So nosocomial pathogens can reach patients by a variety of routes. Now, although the relative contribution of each vector is disputed, transmission by healthcare workers' hands is considered the most likely. The hands of a healthcare worker can become contaminated in a number of ways. The healthcare worker themselves may be colonized with a potential pathogen, Staphylococcus aureus, for example, and an absent-minded rub of the nose or a slightly stressed hand through the hair can contaminate the hand. And if these bacteria are not removed, they can then be transferred to a patient. And similarly, during patient care, contact with a colonized or infected patient can result in high numbers of bacteria being transferred to the hands of a healthcare worker. Again, if these bacteria are not removed, they can be carried to elsewhere within the ward and readily transferred between patients. Colonized and infected patients can also readily contaminate their immediate environment, their bed rail or their overbed table, for example. And bacteria can easily be picked up from environmental surfaces by the hands of a healthcare worker, and if they're not removed, transferred to a non-infected patient. These transmission pathways can become more and more involved. During patient care, the hands of a healthcare worker may become heavily contaminated. Subsequent contact with a near patient or wider ward environment may transfer potential pathogens to items of equipment or furniture. These bacteria may then be picked up by the hands of a second healthcare worker and transferred to an as yet uncolonized patient. So the easiest way to break even the most complicated of these transmission pathways and prevent potential pathogens from reaching the patient is to perform adequate hand hygiene before patient contact. Performing hand hygiene after patient contact should minimize the number of bacteria on the hands in the first instance, and in doing so, help prevent bacteria being transferred directly between patients, and also reduce the number transferred to environmental surfaces. Now, since colonized patients will continue to contaminate their immediate environment, to minimize the number of bacteria picked up from environmental surfaces, hand hygiene should also be performed after contact with a patient's surroundings. Now, these points, or moments, where the transmission pathway can be broken form the basis of the World Health Organization's My 5 Moments for Hand Hygiene. And these guidelines state that hand hygiene should be performed before patient contact, before performing a clean or aseptic procedure, after exposure to body fluids, after patient contact, and after touching a patient's surroundings. Now, this and other hand hygiene campaigns are helping to improve and sustain improvements in hand hygiene compliance. Unfortunately, though, hand hygiene is still often poorly performed. Reasons given by healthcare workers for them not cleaning their hands include a lack of hand washing facilities, or that the products used cause skin irritation. They've reported feeling protected whilst wearing gloves, and because of this, tend not to change gloves between patients. And an outbreak of Acinetobacter has been directly attributed to nurses moving from patient to patient whilst wearing contaminated latex gloves. Healthcare workers have also admitted to not really thinking about why or when they should clean their hands, or simply forgetting, particularly if they are busy. Now, how workload, and as a result, ward type can affect hand hygiene compliance has also been noted by researchers. In general, the more opportunities there are for hand hygiene, the more likely opportunities will be missed. So I'm going to use a few more of these link analyses later, but just as way of an example, the diagram on the next slide illustrates the movement of staff in and around a four-bedded surgical bay over a 90-minute period. The thicker the arrow, the more travelled the route. So you can see a fairly fat arrow pointing to the medical notes trolley in the bottom right-hand corner, illustrating a fair amount of movement from outside the bay to the trolley, and likewise to the clinical information centre. So in contrast to this GI bay, where the medical notes trolley and clinical information centre appear to represent two hubs of staff activity, as you can see in the next slide, that an ICU bay is generally a far busier environment. And it's been estimated that in a busy ICU, there are about 33 hand hygiene opportunities an hour, so about one every couple of minutes. Now, it's also been reported that the need to wash hands is strongly influenced by the emotional concepts of clean and dirty. Healthcare workers are more likely to wash their hands during activities perceived as posing a greater personal risk, for example, after exposure to body fluids, taking a pulse or touching equipment or furniture located within the near patient environment is not seen as a threat and does not trigger an immediate desire to wash hands. Now, how activity can influence hand hygiene behaviour is illustrated in this next pie chart. During the study I will talk more about in a minute, 58 90-minute hand hygiene audits were conducted using the World Health Organization's 5 Moments for Hand Hygiene observational tool. Overall hand hygiene compliance was 50%. But of those hand hygiene opportunities that were missed, none occurred after exposure to body fluids. 24% occurred after patient contact, and 43% occurred after touching equipment or furniture within the near patient environment. Now, this is in agreement with other studies which have also demonstrated that whilst the majority of hand hygiene opportunities occur after contact with the patient's surroundings, these opportunities are also those that are most commonly missed, so are those that are associated with the lowest levels of compliance. So hand hygiene compliance is comparatively poor after contact with a patient's surroundings, but does this really matter? The role of environmental surfaces in the transmission of infection remains a subject of much debate. Certainly the presence of potential pathogens on surfaces within the vicinity of a non-infected patient does not often result in acquisition of an infection. Nonetheless, studies have demonstrated that enforcing or enhancing routine environmental cleaning measures can result in a reduction in surface contamination, cleaner healthcare worker hands, and a reduction in the transmission of pathogens, suggesting then that environmental surfaces do act as a source from which healthcare workers can contaminate their hands and can serve as vectors for cross-transmission. So how can environmental surfaces become contaminated? Well, as already mentioned, colonized patients readily contaminate their immediate environment. Their movement around a ward can also lead to heavy contamination of the wider ward environment, particularly the patient toilet and shower facilities. Bacteria picked up by the hands of a healthcare worker can also be transferred to environmental surfaces. And although routine cleaning reduces environmental contamination, bacteria picked up from surfaces during cleaning can remain viable within cleaning cloths and mops, and the cleaning process itself has been implicated in the widespread contamination of hospital wards. Bioaerosols result from a range of ward activities. Bed making and mechanical floor cleaning, for example, have been shown to liberate large numbers of bacteria into the air. If these bacteria are attached to relatively large particles, such as skin cells, they'll fall to the floor or other nearby surface relatively quickly. But if they are attached to smaller particles, such as those produced during an episode of diarrhea, they can remain suspended for longer periods and be carried through the air and land on surfaces located elsewhere within the ward. So to determine how far potential pathogens and associated risk can spread from source, we carried out a microbiological survey to investigate the type, level, distribution and dissemination of bacteria within a ward environment. This study was conducted with an ICU and a gastrointestinal surgical ward over a 4-month period. And during this time, almost 4,000 surfaces were sampled using agar contact plates. Now, in case you're unaware, contact plates are a very simple method of sampling environmental surfaces. They are simply pressed onto the surface to be sampled, and any bacteria present on the surface are transferred to the agar plate. After incubation, these bacteria become visible as bacterial colonies. Now, there are other ways of sampling surfaces, swabs for example, and sometimes use of swabs is preferable if you wanted to sample the inside of a tap, say. But in my experience, contact plates are the most appropriate way of sampling the healthcare environment, particularly if low numbers of bacteria are likely to be present. So twice a week for 17 weeks, samples were taken from 62 predetermined sites within each ward type. 45 surfaces were within an open 4 or 5-bedded bay, and 17 surfaces were within a single isolation room. Each surface was located within a theoretical zone of increasing distance from the patient. Staff activity and hand hygiene compliance was also observed. Hand hygiene audits were conducted using the WHO's 5 Moments tool, and the movement of staff within the ward or bed space was described in terms of sequential events. So computer to patient, patient to equipment trolley, trolley to patient, that kind of thing. And this data was then used to determine the routes most travelled and the surfaces of highest contact with and without hand hygiene. So this next graph illustrates the average number of bacteria recovered from surfaces within the different ward zones. The GI surgical ward tended to be more contaminated than the ICU, particularly those surfaces associated with a wider bed space, which included paper towel dispensers, bin lids and sinks. However, in general, the highest numbers of bacteria were recovered from the surfaces located in the zone closest to the patient, most notably the bed rails. Now, the bed rail is one of the few surfaces in the ward environment that is touched by patients, staff, and visitors. As a result, bed rails can become heavily contaminated and potentially form a significant reservoir of pathogenic bacteria near to the patient. During another of our recent studies, we sampled almost 3,500 bed rails, of which only 3% were contaminated with MRSA, clearly demonstrating that if inadequately cleaned and decontaminated, the bed rail can pose a risk of infection to patients. However, we also demonstrated a marked difference in the number of organisms recovered from different types of bed rail. The rails associated with the type of bed primarily used within the ICU of Hospital A were significantly more likely to be contaminated with MRSA than those associated with beds used in Hospital B. As this next graph shows, around 80 beds in Hospital A were contaminated with MRSA, compared to about 10 in Hospital B, despite a higher incidence of MRSA in Hospital B. So the beds in Hospital A had moulded plastic rails, whereas those at Hospital B had painted stainless steel rails. And to investigate whether surface coating or finish influenced contamination levels, we conducted a laboratory-based study in which we artificially contaminated the two different types of bedrail with Staph aureus. We then cleaned the rails using either a damp microfiber cloth or an antibacterial wipe. And as you can see in this next graph, the antibacterial wipe effectively reduced the number of bacteria on both rails to below detectable levels. However, whilst rail B could also be effectively cleaned using a damp microfiber cloth, microfiber cleaning was less effective in removing bacteria from rail A, and this difference in cleanability likely contributed to the differences in MRSA contamination that we observed during our previous study. We also assessed the number of bacteria transferred from a contaminated bed rail to the hand during contact. Interestingly, just as fewer bacteria were removed from rail A during cleaning, rail A transferred comparatively fewer bacteria to the fingertips on contact, particularly a fluid of the type that might also be present on the bed rail in practice was also present, feces or blood, for example. So although it was comparatively easy to remove bacteria from rail B during cleaning, this rail was more likely to transfer Staph aureus to fingertips. So if cleaning should be inadequate, rail B could pose the greatest risk in terms of cross-transmission. Now, as you all know, hospital beds, particularly ICU beds, are used to transport critically ill patients within the ward, to and from isolation, say, or elsewhere within the hospital, maybe to and from theatre. Obviously, great care must be taken, and the bed rails are likely to be used to help manoeuvre the bed along corridors and through the doors. During our recent ward survey, a patient admitted to the ICU developed a C. difficile infection. The bed rail was heavily contaminated with C. difficile, as were other surfaces within the patient's immediate environment. The patient and bed were transferred to an isolation room, where again C. difficile was recovered from the bed rail. So it should be remembered that the patient zone is not a static zone within the bed space. The patient zone actually can move with the patient. And the presence of high numbers of bacteria on bed rails increases the risk of them being picked up by the hands of healthcare workers when moving the bed and then being transferred to other environmental surfaces such as door panels and lift buttons. It's perhaps impractical to suggest that when moving a bed, healthcare workers gel their hands before opening every door. But wiping the rails with an alcohol wipe before transporting the patient should perhaps be considered. If we just now consider the isolation room, this next figure illustrates the movement of staff within a single isolation room during a 90-minute period, and it gives some idea as to the activity involved in caring for a critically ill patient. During our observation sessions, a total of 154 people were observed to enter the room, and 137 people were observed to leave, meaning that the door was used and the inner and outer door handle touched on 291 occasions. A recent study published in the journal PLOS ONE demonstrated a significant correlation between the frequency of movement through a door and the degree to which it is contaminated. Inside the room, the surfaces other than the patient that were most commonly touched were the computer, the equipment trolley, and the bed rail. And these high contact sites were also the sites most likely to be contaminated with C. difficile. In contrast, enterococci were isolated from all sample sites on at least one occasion. Although the heaviest and most widespread contamination was seen when the room was occupied by a patient with liquid stool or confirmed C. difficile, enterococci was recovered from the environment of a range of different patients. Attending to a patient with a known infectious disease may improve both glove and hand hygiene compliance, but inadequate hand hygiene or improper glove use can result in widespread fecal contamination, even when treating a patient with non-infectious diarrhea. And this is particularly relevant considering that the proportion of VRE colonized patients far exceeds those infected. Without active surveillance, many of these VRE carriers remain unidentified. And during our ward survey, we sampled the environment of a patient isolated for a gentamicin-resistant Proteus mirabilis infection. This patient had also been infected with MRSA and treated with vancomycin. And over an 8-week sampling period, Proteus mirabilis was isolated on two occasions, once from the bed control panel and once from the nurse call button, and MRSA was isolated just once. This patient was not known to be VRE positive, but environmental sampling revealed heavy, widespread and persistent VRE contamination. VRE was recovered throughout the near patient environment from both the inner and outer room door handles, and despite the immobility of the patient, the ensuite toilet and shower area. Stool analysis confirmed that the patient was colonised with the same VRE strain as that recovered from the environment, although in the interim, this patient had been transferred to a different hospital without recognition of VRE colonisation. The positive environmental cultures are a significant risk factor for VRE acquisition, so placing this patient or any unrecognised carrier in an open bay would increase the risk of VRE being picked up from an environmental surface by the hands of a healthcare worker and transferred to an uncolonised patient, particularly if the nurse-to-patient staffing ratio is relatively high. Now, in our study, in the GI ward, the nurse-to-patient ratio was 1 to 8, and as a result, staff movement between patients and between bed spaces was common. The observed hand hygiene compliance when moving from patient to patient or from bed to bed was relatively low. Overall hand hygiene in the bay was about 34%, with the majority, in fact, half of missed hand hygiene opportunities occurring after contact with the patient's surroundings. Now, low hand hygiene compliance may have been due to the low perceived risk of the activity being undertaken, such as reading notes or observation charts. One of the most common observed activities was taking a patient's case notes from the bed area to a common or work area. And this next graph shows the average number of bacteria recovered from surfaces within the bed area. And although not quite as contaminated as the bed control panel, the call button or patient chair, the case note folders were consistently contaminated with relatively high numbers of bacteria. And these included Staphylococcus aureus, both MRSA and MSSA, fecal contaminants such as enterococci and E. coli, and potential multi-resistant pathogens such as Acinetobacter baumannii and Stenotrophomonas multifilia. So most staff movement in and around the surgical ward was observed to take place within the wider ward environment, particularly around the medical notes trolley and the clinical information station. Although these activities themselves did not require hand hygiene, as this next graph shows, there was still scope for bacteria present on the desk chairs, computer keyboards, or even a pen and stapler to contaminate the hands of a healthcare worker and be transferred to a patient or other environmental sites within the ward or even between wards. Both VRE and MRSA were isolated from the containers used within the pneumatic tube system. Unlike the GI ward, in the ICU, where the nurse-to-patient ratio was 1 to 1, staff movement was very much focused around one bed, with the equipment trolley, the computer and the bed rail being the surfaces most commonly touched. 14 90-minute observation sessions were conducted in the ICU bay, and observed hand hygiene compliance was 57% higher than in the GI ward. Comparatively fewer hand hygiene opportunities were missed after touching the near patient environment, but more opportunities were missed after patient contact, particularly when moving from patient to equipment trolley and from patient to computer, demonstrating how potential pathogens can be transferred from patient to high contact sites within the near patient environment. And certainly, you can see in this next graph that the computer keyboard was one of the most heavily contaminated surfaces within the bed space. And the use of electronic patient records is becoming more common, and staff are increasingly using computers in the management of patients. Conventional computer keyboards are difficult to clean, and as a result can become heavily contaminated. Smooth, flat keyboards facilitate cleaning and the removal of microorganisms, and bacterial counts can be further reduced if the keyboard incorporates a cleaning reminder, like the ones pictured in the next slide. Now, cleaning reminders, such as a visual alarm, can be activated on an adjustable timer, typically 12 hours for most clinical locations and 3 hours for where the transmission of infection is more critical in the ICU, for example. Various timing parameters, not just our own minutes, can be set. It may be that cleaning is prompted after a set number of characters have been typed. Nonetheless, a visual alarm is easy to ignore, and if cleaning compliance is poor, even easy to clean keyboards can become heavily contaminated. And in our study, although the keyboards in the ICU had been designed to be easy to clean, incorporated a visual alarm to promote cleaning compliance, and also sensors to detect when cleaning had been performed, you can see looking back at the previous graph that the average number of bacteria recovered from the enter key of over 30 keyboards was about 30 colonies, more than one bacterial colony per centimetre squared. So in an attempt to improve cleaning compliance, software that causes a cleaning reminder to appear on the monitor screen has been developed. The window is projected when the visual alarm starts to flash and remains on the screen until the keyboard senses it has been cleaned. Wiping with an alcohol or detergent wipe causes the light to stop flashing and the window to disappear. So to determine if the software does in fact improve cleaning compliance and as a result reduce the numbers of bacteria contaminating the keyboard, we installed this software on 9 of 20 ICU ward computers. Agar contact plates were used to sample the enter key of all 20 keyboards on a daily basis over a period of a month. And whether the visual alarm was flashing at the time the samples were taken was also noted. And this next graph shows the effect of installing the software upon the number of bacteria recovered from the keyboards. As you can see, significantly fewer bacteria were recovered from the test keyboards, so those which had the software installed, than from the control keyboards. Test keyboards were also less likely to have a flashing visual alarm than the control keyboards, implying then that the activation of the software prompted staff to wipe the keyboard, improving cleaning compliance and reducing the level of bacterial contamination. Now, including the keyboard, a total of 977 surfaces were sampled within the near patient environment of the ICU bay. Of these, 6% were contaminated with enterococci, and the surfaces most likely to be contaminated were the controls to adjust the bed, the bin lids and the privacy curtain. So those surfaces most likely to be touched when maintaining a patient's personal needs and hygiene. But whilst the bed control and the bin lids should be cleaned on a regular basis and would be considered easy to clean surfaces, the cleanliness of a privacy curtain is more difficult to maintain. And during our observation sessions, it was noted that hand hygiene was often performed before drawing the curtains. A healthcare worker would perform hand hygiene, enter the bed space, and then draw the curtains around the patient. However, bacteria may have previously been transferred from a contaminated hand to the curtain, and if so, a second healthcare worker, when drawing the curtain after performing hand hygiene, may inadvertently recontaminate their hands before then touching the patient. Now, a scenario similar to this may have occurred during our recent ward survey. Although no MRSA-positive patients were present in the ICU bay at the time, MRSA was recovered from the curtain surrounding one of the patients. This MRSA was still present on the curtain at least 3 days later, and the patient occupying the bed space acquired the same MRSA strain 9 days after it was first isolated from the environment. So performing hand hygiene immediately before patient contact, so after drawing the privacy curtain, should prevent any bacteria transferred from the curtain to the hands of a healthcare worker from reaching the patient. Of course, also performing hand hygiene before drawing the curtain will help reduce the number of bacteria transferred to the curtain in the first instance. Disposable antimicrobial curtains are available, but the limited studies so far have been published suggest that their efficacy is limited, so more work probably needs to be done. Similarly, inadequate hand hygiene when entering or leaving an isolation room can lead to heavy contamination of the door handles. If the handles are inadequately cleaned, hands decontaminated outside the room are likely to become recontaminated on entry, and likewise, hands decontaminated inside the room are likely to become recontaminated on exit, potentially leading to pathogens being transferred from an isolated patient to surfaces or non-infected patients elsewhere within the ward. Healthcare workers should perhaps be encouraged to perform hand hygiene before and after entering an isolation room. Alternatively, consideration could be given to alternative entry and exit systems. Push plates have been found to be less contaminated than fixed or lever handles. Alternatively, for operated or automatic non-contact doors could be considered. Contaminated door handles are not limited to isolation rooms. During our ward survey, MRSA was recovered from the staff toilet area on a number of different occasions. On one occasion, the inner door handle was contaminated with high numbers of MRSA. MRSA was also recovered from the flush and the sink, although at much lower levels. In this case, MRSA may have been transferred from a contaminated hand to the handle when the door was pulled closed. Use of the toilet would have led to bacteria being transferred from the hand to the flush. Subsequent hand washing would have reduced the number of hand contaminants, rinsing many of them down the sink. Unfortunately, on exiting the toilet, contact would have again been made with the heavily contaminated handle, leading to the transfer of MRSA and the recontamination of the hand. So just a quick word on how hand hygiene can be performed. A quick squirt of alcohol gel is quick and easy, and in most cases, particularly after contact with environmental surfaces, is all that is needed. Gel should not be used, though, if the hands are visibly dirty or exposure to C. diff is likely. In these cases, and after using the toilet, soap and water should be used. It must be remembered, though, that hand drying is an essential step in the hand washing process. The number of bacteria that can be transferred from a surface, for example, a contaminated door handle, is increased in the presence of moisture. So hand washing must be accompanied by effective hand drying. Okay, so how can hand hygiene be improved? Well, any intervention should provide the cues a healthcare worker uses to identify the need to clean their hands, whilst also providing them with the ability to perform hand hygiene, locating an alcohol gel dispenser en route to a task where hand hygiene is required, for example. It has also been suggested that these cues should be tied to specific events or tasks rather than to general behaviour. As a result, appropriate cues and interventions may differ with ward type, isolation precautions or professional group. During our ward survey, the nurse-to-patient staffing ratio in the GI ward was 1 to 8, and movement from patient to patient or from bed to bed was common. A single non-compliant healthcare worker with a large number or a diverse number of contacts may play a disproportionate role in disseminating pathogens in and around a hospital ward. Raising the awareness of bacterial transfer from surfaces even when conducting seemingly innocuous tasks, such as reading a patient's notes, is important. Could case record folders be illustrated in such a way as to prompt healthcare workers to perform hand hygiene? In the ICU, although the majority of movements centred around one bed, common movement routes were identified, moving from patient to computer, for example. I talked briefly about software that has been designed to improve cleaning compliance. Perhaps a similar strategy could be employed to encourage healthcare workers to perform hand hygiene after using ward computers. I appreciate, though, that these conclusions have been based upon the results of visual observation and that there are problems with visual monitoring. When conducting visual audits, observation sessions are generally short, and although it has been recommended that observations are timed to capture a complete picture of 24-hour activity, audits are usually conducted during normal working hours. Compliance rates tend to increase when staff know they are being observed. During our study, the number of staff and level of activity within the gastrointestinal isolation rooms was generally low, meaning fewer observations could be collected, and the likelihood of staff altering their behaviour as a direct result of being observed was increased. We also found that manual data capture was inadequate to record rapid, multiple, simultaneous activities, and observation was often obscured by curtains or other objects. So as part of the Department of Health high-impact interventions, all NHS trusts require each ward to produce monthly audits of hand hygiene among their staff. And targets for compliance are generally very high, upward of 90%. Now, overt surveillance may help achieve these targets, but if actual hand hygiene compliance is to be demonstrated, continuous automatic monitoring is required. So for the remainder of this talk, I'm just going to talk about Vero Medico, described as being an intelligent hand hygiene monitoring system. which through a device worn by each healthcare worker can detect direct contact between the healthcare worker and a patient or an environmental surface, and then whether appropriate hand hygiene is subsequently performed. The system responds to this information and in real time relays, transmits and records adherence to hygiene protocols. So the long-term plan is that staff-patient contact will be detected via a small device worn by the patient, perhaps incorporated within their identification bracelet. But during our recent trial of the system, devices were only fitted to specific items of furniture, and information was only received regarding direct contact between healthcare worker and environmental surface. And this information was received by a device incorporated within the healthcare worker's identification badge. This device also detected alcohol vapour, and so the use of alcohol gel, and detected the use of soap and water by devices that were installed within the waste outlets of sinks. So the device worn by staff responded to this information by displaying one of three colours. The default setting was amber, indicating that hand hygiene was required. If hand hygiene was performed satisfactorily, the badge changed colour to green. If hand hygiene was not performed, subsequent surface contact resulted in the badge changing from amber to red. Provided the badge was worn externally, the colour could be seen by the healthcare worker, patients and other staff. The healthcare worker was provided with real-time feedback regarding hand hygiene compliance, and patients and other staff members were provided with an obvious prompt to ask for hand hygiene if it had not been adequately performed. And since a picture paints a thousand words, I have included a 30-second video within this presentation, but I realise that many of you won't be able to immediately access. So instead I've given you the web address in case you wish to have a look at it at a later date. Acting aside, it does give an idea as to how the system works. But the aim of our Green Badge project was to determine if ViraMedico, a hand hygiene monitoring system with immediate feedback, improved hand hygiene compliance in a clinical setting, and if such a system is acceptable to staff and patients. The system was installed on three general cardiac care wards. The nursing staff wore the badges for 6 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the study ran for 5 weeks and comprised three key phases. During the first phase, although the devices were receiving and transmitting hand hygiene information, the badges were permanently set to green. The information transmitted and logged was used to determine hand hygiene compliance in the absence of a visual prompt. I should just point out here that all automated data was anonymized, so the data transmitted by a particular badge was associated with the badge rather than with the wearer. So in the second phase, the devices were again receiving and transmitting data, but this time the badges responded to the information received and changed colour accordingly. The information transmitted was used to determine hand hygiene compliance when the need for hand hygiene was relayed to staff in real time. And during this phase, staff and patients were also asked a series of questions relating to the usability and the acceptability of the badge system. And during the final phase of the study, the badges were again set to green and the information transmitted used to again determine hand hygiene compliance in the absence of a visual prompt. The purpose of this phase was to assess whether there had been any permanent effect, had the system been an effective training tool. And during all three phases, compliance rates were compared to those determined by simultaneous visual audits. And the next slide shows the results. During the first phase of the study, so when the badge was set to green, hand hygiene compliance as determined by the ViraMedico system was 22%, much lower than the 43% compliance rate determined through visual observation. When staff were provided with real-time feedback, hand hygiene compliance increased significantly to 66%. And this was on the basis of more than 3,500 first contacts, demonstrating the level of information continuous automated monitoring can generate. In contrast, the results of the visual audit were based on just 9 observation sessions. Nonetheless, an increase in compliance was observed. When staff were no longer provided with a visual prompt, hand hygiene compliance reduced slightly, but was still considerably higher than during the initial study phase, suggesting then that the Vero Medico system is an effective means of improving and perhaps sustaining improvements in hand hygiene compliance, although further studies are, of course, necessary. Well, what about the staff wearing the badges? How did they feel about the system? Well, the majority of staff agreed that the colours on the badge were easy to see. 79% thought that wearing the badge would improve hand hygiene, but just over 0.5% of staff agreed that the system would reduce infections. A quarter of staff were unsure, as they thought it would depend upon the individual and their use of the badge, whether or not they would hide it in the pocket. So the colours of the badge couldn't be seen. Majority of respondents agreed that not all staff would wear the badge, and doctors were thought to be those least likely to wear and be willing to wear the badge. In general, staff were comfortable with being challenged by patients, although only 50% thought a patient would actually challenge a red or absent badge. And indeed, although the patients questioned generally agreed that the colours of the badge were easy to see and agreed that the system was a good idea, their primary concern was their illness and not feeling unable to challenge staff. So to conclude then, hands play an important role in healthcare-associated infection. They can transfer bacteria from a colonised patient to a non-infected patient, either directly or via an environmental surface. Inadequate hand hygiene after patient contact or after contact with a patient's surroundings can contaminate local environmental surfaces and help spread potential pathogens throughout the ward environment. Inadequate cleaning of high contact sites increases the risk of decontaminated hands becoming recontaminated on contact. So whilst hand hygiene is obviously important in controlling transmission, so too is environmental cleaning. Continuous automatic monitoring with immediate feedback may help improve and sustain improvements in hand hygiene compliance. A system such as Vero Medico may also help establish common contact patterns, the routes most commonly travelled, and the surfaces most frequently touched, together with associated hand hygiene compliance. This information, even if collected via visual observation, can help focus hand hygiene training or behaviour change. Finally, I just want to thank you all for listening and to acknowledge the staff and patients in all study wards and everyone else who worked so hard on the various projects I've discussed today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ginny, for a really interesting session and a bit of a different take on hand hygiene. So thanks very much to you. Thank you also to all of you that have listened, and also to Gojo for their sponsorship. If anyone does have any questions for Ginny, then you can email those to info@webertraining.com, and they will be forwarded on to Ginny for her response. So thank you very much. Thank you.